This is an ABC podcast.
My guest on Conversations is Jason Om. Jason grew up in Oakley in Melbourne, the only son of Narong from Cambodia and Patsy from Malaysia. You might have seen Jason on ABC TV, reporting on politics or health or human rights for 7:30, Late Line and other current affairs programs. Well, a few years ago, Jason decided it was time to bring his journalistic skills to his own family story, particularly to finding out the truth about his mother. His memoir is All Mixed Up. Hi, Jason.
Hello. Great to be here.
There is a ridiculously cute photo of you on the cover of this book. Can you describe it?
I like to call it super cute, if I don't say so myself. I think it's a glorious image of me at 3 years old in my favourite Vegemite T-shirt. And this is a photo that Dad took because he was a mad amateur photographer. And I'm sitting in the front yard by the front fence and I've just got this beautiful smile and I'm 3 years old. It's the 1980s. And whenever I look at this image, I just want to give that Jason a big hug because there's lots of promise there, but there's a lot of life to be lived.
Your mum, as I say, was Malaysian and your dad Cambodian. How did they meet one another?
So it is an interesting story how my parents met. Dad came to Australia in the 1960s and he was here. He was in Melbourne as an international student and he was looking for love. And so obviously when you're looking for love and you're a bachelor, you put an ad in the newspaper. And that's what they did. At that time, it's basically like the dating apps of now.
Do you know what he specified?
I don't, because he couldn't find the ad. I've asked him for it, but he's misplaced it. But I would love to read, you know, the specifications. What was he looking for?
But your mum answered. Where did they meet one another on that first date?
So mum wrote back to him, and they met on the steps of Flinders Street Station. It's a very romantic idea, but Flinders Street Station is a major junction in Melbourne. It's where everybody meets at that time or met at that time. Now it's Federation Square, but they met on the steps of Flinders Street Station and Dad didn't know what he was looking for.
They hadn't seen photos.
That's right. It was a blind date because Mum hadn't given him a photo, but he knew that she was Malaysian. And it would have been easy at that time to spot another Asian face in the crowd. And that's where they met. And then they went back to my dad's share house, took a Red Rattler train to Caulfield, and they walked across this oval. And mum sort of, they came across hundreds and hundreds of dandelions in the lawn, and mum was really enraptured by them. And she bent down and said, "Flowers in the field." And I think at that moment, Dad fell in love with mum.
Well, they were married not long after that meeting, and you came along a few years later in 1980. What were your parents doing for work when your mum became pregnant with you?
So both my parents worked in factories. Mum initially worked at General Electric. And then Dad also worked in a couple of factories. And then they also worked in the same factory at the same time. And this was a potato chip factory in Oakley, pumping out Smith's crisps and other goodies. And they worked among the Greeks on the production line, because Oakley is a proud Greek suburb. So they were the only Asian people, I believe, working among those workers.
So, did that mean you had access to a lot of salt and vinegar chips when you were growing up, Jason?
Absolutely, because Dad kept some extra treats in a plastic bag in the garage and he would bring it out as a treat from time to time. And there were these Pac-Man collector cards and burger rings and all those, you know, really tasty treats that kids love.
That's the payoff for that, John.
Yeah.
Your dad, though, was also a radio broadcaster. How did he land that?
So he was in and out of factories and he also had this other side hustle, being a part-time broadcaster at SBS Radio. He set up the Khmer language program there in the late 1970s. And to begin with, he had no radio broadcast experience. But one of his cousins had paid for a trip to the US, and he went to the US and visited the Voice of America, which is a radio station over there. And that's where he learned how to produce radio, and he watched them produce radio programs on reel-to-reel tape machines. And he simply walked into the SBS radio, at that time 3EA studios in South Melbourne, and said to the manager, I've seen them record radio programs on reel-to-reel tape machines. And I don't know how he got the gig, because how could the manager decide whether he was good for radio when he was speaking in Khmer?
Well, it worked. He convinced him.
Yeah, it works. I mean, he used his gumption. He saw an opportunity there and he set up the program.
He's a practical and restrained man, but he did have a few extravagances when you were growing up. Tell me about his clock collection.
There were clocks everywhere in the house. He's quite obsessive about them. And there were clocks on the mantelpiece and, you know, clocks with dances, you know, spinning dances. There was another clock which was told the international world time, and there was even one, you know, later in the toilet as well, because, you know, he wanted to time his poos, I would have thought. But I think it's because he's mechanically minded. He trained as a mechanical engineer, and so I like to think of Dad as this. He's scientific, he's mechanical, he's kind of a machine man. You know, he's not really in touch with his emotions, but he's very practical. He likes his gears and gadgets, and he's still like that today. He's still got all these, like, clocks in the house.
You were your parents' only child. Was there a little bit of spoiling of this gorgeous, precocious boy, do you think?
Absolutely. I agree with the rest of my family that I was a bit of a spoiled brat, because as an only child, I hold all my parents' dreams in a way. They invest their life in one child, and that's what happened. But I also think that there was some compensation there. They were compensating for the fact that Dad was away at work, sometimes 6 days a week, sometimes at night, and Mum also struggled with mental health problems as well. So I think there was a largesse there that my other relatives didn't quite understand, where they were trying to overcompensate for the chaos in our lives.
You tell some lovely stories about your mum in this memoir, Jason, some of her kindnesses and kind of innocence in a way. What happened when you told her that you wanted a bird like the one on the cover of the Fruit Loop cereal packet?
Well, I loved Fruit Loops, and like any kid, you know, any household, there was sugary treats for breakfast. And I love the image of the toucan on the box. And we were walking in the Oakley Mall one day past the pet shop, as we usually did, because I love pets and Mum loved animals as well. And we walked past and I said to Mum, can you go in there and find out whether they've got a toucan? This is Oakley in the 1980s. And so she thought, okay, what was the bird again? Oh, it's a toucan. Okay, so she went into the pet store and she asked the man there, who sort of looked at her weirdly, and then she came out and said, no, they don't have a toucan. And obviously that sort of bird is too exotic to be in Australia, let alone the Melbourne suburbs.
Give you a good deal on this budgie, but there's no toucans in stock at the
moment. Yeah, it was very disappointing.
She did, though, have other moods, more difficult and darker moods. What are some of the tougher things for you to remember when you look back at her when you were a kid?
Yeah, look, Mum was the only person in my family who hugged and kissed. She was touchy-feely, and really she was the heart in my family. But at the same time, she could be cruel and bizarre and strange.
Were there times that you were nervous going out in public with your mum?
Yeah, because Mum used to say Mum had a nervous breakdown in the third person as well. She said Mum had a nervous breakdown. And as a child, that's very confusing because it's not explained. What does a nervous breakdown mean? It's a euphemism for something else. And so when she was acting weirdly, that created a gulf between me and her, because when your mum's acting strangely, it's baffling, and you don't know whether your mum loves you or not. And that's how I grew up, I question whether Mum actually loved me, because she would say, "You're a mistake," or "Get out of my sight." And in those moments, I didn't know what was going on. It was very topsy-turvy. It was a seesaw, because she had no control over her emotions. And she was effectively incapacitated in a way, because Dad was her carer and she needed a lot of care. So it was very tense, because I couldn't really bring friends over, because it was a little bit embarrassing, because Mum would be aimlessly walking around the house when other mums would know, oh, we've got to entertain the kids and, you know, put on food and the like. But I didn't really have that. So it was difficult to accept her for who she was because of her behaviour.
One day when you were six or so, Jason, and playing with some matchbox cars, your mum told you some new information about your family. What did she say?
Well, this was Mum's way. She had a big announcement. So I was on the porch and she came out the front door and said, "Jason, you've got a sister, a half-sister in Malaysia." And I'm 6 years old. How am I supposed to process that? And again, it was another confusing thing that came out of my mum's mouth. It was this bombshell that I had to deal with. And from that moment, my world changed, because up until that time, I was and still was an only child. It was just me, Mum, Dad, living in the cream brick veneer house in Melbourne. And suddenly there was this girl in our lives from out of the blue, dropping out of the sky practically, who was 10 years older than me. She lived in Malaysia. And what was her story? What was she about? And I felt a little bit jealous, because suddenly I had to share Mum with this girl who was not even in our lives. She was living in another country and she didn't live with us.
Alongside the clocks and the watches and the cameras, your dad had a lot of audio equipment at home that you'd play with. And there's an audio cassette of a Q&A you did with your parents when you were a budding journalist of 10. Let's listen to some of that.
"Hello, I'm Jason Om, and we're going to interview Narong and Patsy."
"Okay, Patricia. What do you do for a living?"
"Housewife."
"Housewife. Any jobs?"
"No jobs."
"How old are you?"
42.
"Any comments about your life?"
"No."
"How many children do you have?"
"Two."
"A male or a female?"
Girl and boy."
"Okay, I'm going to ask you a question for both of you. What internationality are you, Narong?"
"Nationality."
"Well, whatever.
Cambodian."
"What are you?"
"Eurasian."
"What's your son's nationality?"
"My son's nationality is Australian."
"What about your son and daughter?"
"Malaysian and Australian."
"Okay, that's the latest update. Back to your local scene."
You've got quite a forceful interviewing style there, Jason.
I was a very bossy child. I pushed my parents around, as my auntie says. But it was a very gloomy time, because when that recording happened, Dad had just lost his job. It was 1990 and it was the recession we had to have. And I just thought, you know what? My parents need cheering up. And so I ordered them into the lounge room, set up a blue folding table, put the mic on the stand, because Dad had taught me how to do this, and they sat opposite each other and fired off these questions.
What was it like to listen to that cassette when you came across it again?
Well, I cried, because that is the only recording of Mum's voice, I believe, that's in existence. And Dad had all these contraptions, and I had a favourite cassette recorder. It was in a leather case. It was single deck. And I would take that recorder and walk around the house and stick it into the cat's face, or stick it into the dog's face, and stick it into Mum's face and demand them say something. And you know, there were a lot of recordings of Mum, but this is one that I was able to retrieve. And so it was a bolt out of the blue in that sense, because I couldn't remember Mum's voice. It was the one thing about her that I couldn't remember. But then listening to that recording, she's suddenly back in my life. And it was very touching to hear her. But also it was quite funny and entertaining, because I've got this, you know, my balls haven't dropped, and I kind of have this Cockney accent in it as well. Well, perhaps it's a Victorian, you know, broad Victorian accent. And I'm just so, yeah, it's like an interrogation.
Then she meets that interrogation with a tenderness. You know, she gently corrects your internationality.
That's
to nationality,
right.
And
that's
she's
right.
Willing to go along. There's a real, quite a lovely presence of her in that recording.
Yeah, and Dad played along as well. I mean, I said to him, "What do you do?" And he said, "Oh, unemployed."
Thanks, son. Yeah.
What else do you do? You know, what else? What other job besides being unemployed? So he was a good sport in that. And, you know, when I did that recording, because there were a lot of tensions in my parents' marriage and Dad was away at work, it was lovely just to have them in the same room in front of the mic and talking and together as a family. Yeah.
You say, Jason, that's the last recording, or perhaps the only recording there is of your mum's voice. Tell me what happened one night when you were 12 and up late watching the tennis.
Yeah, so when I was 12, I was at home. It was the middle of the night. I was watching late-night TV and there was a strange noise coming from Mum's bedroom, and I had to go and investigate. And when I did, I found Mum collapsed in the bed. She was choking, and I was the one who had to call the ambulance. I did CPR on her as best as I could, and then ran out to get an adult.
You were there alone at that point, just you and your mum at home.
That's right, because Dad was out at that time. He was at a Cambodian wedding reception celebrating with friends. And so that was quite normal for us, because Dad would be out at work or out with friends and I'd be there with Mum and we'd be watching TV. And it was always the case that I would always beg her to stay with me, because I was, you know, even at that age I was a bit spooked. And I liked having Mum sitting on the couch next to me watching TV. You know, I liked having her there. She was a warm presence. But that night she went to bed early.
What do you remember about the ambulance arriving?
I remember very distinctly that when the ambulance arrived, I remembered the lights flashing through the darkness. And I don't remember any sound, but I remember that the ambulance was coming very slowly towards the house. And at that stage, I had called a neighbour to come and help as well. And then the ambulance officers turned up and, you know, they took control of the situation. But there was nothing much that they could do at that stage. They did try to revive her. And then Dad arrived from the wedding, and my Uncle Johnny came on his pushbike from my Nan's house, because I had called my Nan before the ambulance. And that's something that I lived to regret and I felt guilty about, because after that moment I wasn't the brave little boy that was going to be on National 9 News with the over-the-top voiceover saying, you know, this is the brave boy who saved his mum. I felt a real deep sense of guilt over that, which I carried throughout my life.
You were the brave boy who did CPR and went and got grown-ups, though, Jason. When did you next see your mum?
So after that, she was taken to hospital and she was in a coma for quite some time. And I remember walking up to the bed and thinking that she was more machine than woman, because she had all these apparatuses around her, and I sort of went to hold her hand, and it was engorged with, like a rubber glove, with water. And someone explained to me, there was an explanation, I don't remember what it was, but there was an explanation for it. And after 6 days, Dad had to make a decision about whether to turn off the life support, and you know, he described it as, well, if you know, the doctor said, well, if mum wakes up, she might have brain damage and we might have to look after her. So dad had to make that very difficult decision and give her dignity and turn off the life support.
What was the house like without your mum in it?
It was really cold because, as I said before, mum was the heart in our family and the warmth in our family. And dad suddenly had to take care of his son because we had a very traditional family structure. Mum was in the kitchen and mum looked after me. She was in the house and dad went out to work. He was the main breadwinner. So without mum, I didn't have that softness and the tenderness. And my teenage years were really difficult because suddenly me and dad were thrust together and we clashed. We were very, and are still, very different personalities.
Did you talk about your mum much, you and your dad?
I tried to talk about mum, but dad is not a talker. And whenever I tried to approach it with him, he would just kind of shut me down with a grunt. And we didn't talk about it until many, many years later.
What role did a woman called Betty take on in your family life?
Yeah, so Betty was our family confidant. She was, you know, a formidable family friend who took care of us and took care of dad. And in the wake of mum's death, we were hopeless, me and dad. We didn't know what to do because dad didn't cook. And so we were in an emergency situation. And Betty intervened and she was the one who sort of took control and said, look, this is what you got to do. This is what you can cook. These are the recipes you can manage. Here's some, you know, frozen meals, take them home. And so she saved our lives because up until that point we were eating, you know, sickly grey microwave meals and just sandwich. Dad sort of, you know, thought, let's make sandwiches, great, you know, which is something, but it's not a proper meal.
It's pushing, you know, even your love of Vegemite maybe
exactly.
A stretch too far. At high school, you got your own series of different jobs, including at Hungry Jack's, where you worked your way up to the very prestigious position of actually being able to interact with the public.
Yes.
What kind of persona did you have in those settings outside of your home?
Well, Hungry Jack's was one of, I have to say, it was one of the most enjoyable jobs I've had in my career. In fact, I thought of, you know, I even almost went down that path of becoming Hungry Jack's manager. But I was on front counter and not many boys made it onto front counter. But perhaps I was moving sales, you know, perhaps I was working the tills quite well. And I sort of treated that as a grand stage where I could practice my presenter's voice.
What kind of lines? Do you remember what your line was at Hungry Jack's?
Welcome to Hungry Jack's Oakley. How can I help you?
Still got it.
And yeah, and that's how I practice my voice. I thought of being on the radio or on the TV and I was in the spotlight.
Well, you were also doing some acting gigs. How did that come about for you as a kid?
That was a side hustle that Dad vehemently disagreed with, but he sort of tolerated. I went to drama school and I sort of picked up work through an agent as well. There were extra jobs and... It, you know, Dad sort of said, you can't make money being an actor. But I was scoring, you know, these small roles were earning me, you know, hundreds of dollars a gig. And that's a lot of money for someone who's, you know, 14, 15 years
old. That's a lot of hours at Hungry Jack's.
Well, it is. And to do not much as well, you know, if you're an extra, you just sort of wait around, you know, you've got one scene and then that's it. I mean, that's easy money.
The other thing that was happening for you at high school was an awareness that you were attracted to guys, not girls. Who did you first come out to?
I had feelings for guys since I was in primary school. And in high school, I still had those feelings, but I was in a deep sense of denial and I would still date girls to my peril. And, you know, that was a, you know, dangerous liaison. But I didn't come out to my friend until I was in uni. I was 18 years old and one of my best friends, Kavindi, who I'm still friends with, we were going out to dinner one night. We were out in the suburbs at my place in Oakley and it just came out. I thought it was time. It was time to shed the denial and be my true self.
You then took the step of coming out to your dad. Did that feel like a big risk?
It was a huge risk because Dad was so strict and stern towards me that I seriously thought that I would be thrown out of the house. That was a real risk. But by that stage, I'd already moved out. I was in a share house in North Melbourne and I was at uni. I had, you know, had a few jobs going, not Hungry Jack's, but like I had a few other jobs going, and I was safe and secure in that financially. So he couldn't really, I suppose, you know, lay a hand on me, I would say. He couldn't, you know, he didn't have that authority over me anymore, and I was independent. So when I came out to him, was at the share house, and the first thing he said was, "But we sent you to Catholic school." And I told him, "Look, it's not a phase. This is who I am. This is not a phase." And he sort of said, "Oh, okay," and then went back home.
Podcast, broadcast, and online. This is Conversations with Sarah Kanofsky. Find out more about the Conversations podcast. Just head to abc.net.au/conversations.
Jason, in the years following your mum's death, had you stayed or been in contact with this sister, this mysterious sister that your mother revealed you had living in Malaysia?
The mysterious girl in Malaysia. Well, after mum died, I tried to reach out to her by writing some letters because mum used to write to her as when I was growing up, and I was fossicking, trying to find my sister's address and found one, and then I started writing to her. And in those first letters, we didn't actually even acknowledge that mum had died. It was, you know, effectively papering over this family cataclysm, and we didn't address it. And it was all very friendly. And then there was this angry letter as well where some words were said, and then we kind of cut off contact. So it was a very long time before I then got in contact with her again. So, you know, this is in my teens that we were in contact, and then there was a blackout for a very, very long time.
When you did get back in touch with her, where was she living?
She was still in Malaysia, in the capital, in Kuala Lumpur. And she was, I think, at that time at uni, perhaps, or maybe she'd already finished and she was already working.
So where did you first lay eyes on one another, you and your sister?
So I was in uni and I felt that it was time to meet her because I was thinking about mum again and I was thinking about my sister Sarah and what happened to her. And I got in contact with her again through another cousin, and it just so happened that she was in Melbourne studying for a PhD by chance. And, it was time. I had sort of discarded all the childhood misgivings about my sister, about her being this strange girl. And I wanted to know who she was. And we also met on the steps of Flinders Street Station, like my parents. And it was a blind date in a sense because I knew my sister's face through a photo that I had from childhood that she'd given us, but I didn't know what she looked like, in my 20s. I was in my 20s, she was in her 30s, and she was there on the steps, and she reminded me of mum because she had this long wavy hair and rosy cheeks and was kind of the same build as well, and it was a strange yet natural meeting. It felt natural.
You must have had so many questions for one another. What did she want to know from you?
So every time, you know, we went to a cafe and the first thing she wanted to know was what was Mum like? And this was so incredibly hard for me to answer because of all of the feelings that I had towards Mum, all the mixed up feelings and the stigma I had towards her mental illness. And, you know, part of me wanted to say, oh, she was crazy and, you know, say all these mean things. But I didn't have an answer. I didn't have an answer for a proper answer for her to say, you know, Mum was this and Mum was that, because I honestly couldn't remember, because I'd built up a barricade in my mind around the night I called the ambulance, but also around Mum and her confusing behaviour. And so I felt, you know, it was a bit of a weak answer because I didn't have an answer for her. But she wanted to know because she didn't know Mum. I had 12 years of physically having her, of having the embraces and having the hugs and the kisses, but my sister didn't have that. She was in Malaysia.
Over the years, as time went on, Jason, you were building your career in journalism, having your heart broken, all of the usual stuff that happens in someone's 20s.
Many a time.
How often was your mum in your mind?
Well, she wasn't. From that night that I called the ambulance, I blocked her out. I banished her from my memory and I ran. I ran as far as I could. And during uni, there were times that there were cracks in the wall. You know, obviously I had my sister clear and present in front of me, but there were other times. So, you know, there was one time where I was with my boyfriend at that time and we were sitting in a cinema and we were watching a movie, and there was this scene of a mum in a coma in a hospital, and I had this involuntary reaction where I ran out of the cinema and was crying on the street. So there were times where, you know, Mum was trying to push through the wall where the memories would come back to me. And in adulthood, there would be other times, like when I'm driving through an intersection to let an ambulance pass, or even at work when I'm about to go into a TV studio to present the news, I'd be doing my tie in the mirror and I'd kind of well up and think about Mum.
What led to you deciding that you were going to turn and face this person and this story, try to break down that wall a little?
I had to run to a safe distance to turn my head. And in 2013, that was the 20th anniversary of Mum's death. And it was quite mind-boggling to think, wow, it's been 20 years since that event and I survived. But I hadn't addressed everything. I hadn't confronted my past. I didn't know who she was. I was trying to avoid it. The 20th anniversary coincided with my grandmother's death as well. And then suddenly all of the feelings and everything came crashing through the wall. And I realised I've got to work out what the hell was going on with Mum and what the hell was my confusing childhood about.
What did your dad make of your new interest and wanting to talk to him about your mum and their past together?
Keep in mind that me and Dad had not spoken about Mum for 20 years, which is a strange thing for a father and son, but it's a huge silence. And the first thing I wanted to do was investigate. And at that time I was working for Late Line and I wanted to turn my investigative skills on my family, a kind of blowtorch, but on very, very low heat and very gently.
Gentle blowtorch.
Yeah, very, very gentle blowtorch. And so the first task was to speak to Dad because he's the first, you know, the first source. And I sat him down and he was surprisingly willing and surprisingly open. And perhaps he was also at a point in his life where he was prepared to talk about it.
What could he tell you about this nervous breakdown that your mum herself had referred to when you were little and that your dad had referred to?
Yeah, look, not a great deal, because he couldn't pinpoint where it happened or precisely when it happened. He just referred to it as a nervous breakdown, that Mum was babbling nonsense for a while. So something happened to her, But he couldn't paint a picture of exactly where that was and how it happened. All he knew was that he needed to take his wife to the doctor, and that's what he did. And he had some really bad experiences to begin with doctors. There was a first psychiatrist who he believed overdosed mum on medication and made her into this dribbling zombie. And then he found another psychiatrist who took good care of her.
What did he suggest that you do in terms of that psychiatrist, in terms of making contact?
Well, it wasn't actually Dad's suggestion. I remembered this psychiatrist because me and Mum used to take a bus to see him. You know, this is very unusual for a child, but this was normal in my childhood where we would take a bus. We'd get on the bus, go to Mum's doctor, and I would sit out in the waiting room while Mum went into the consulting room. And Dr. Chong was his name. He was this spectacled Chinese-Malaysian man. He was very kind and very gentle. And I needed to find him because I wanted medical records. I knew that I needed documentation to understand what was going on in Mum's head. So I did a bit of Googling, tried to find Dr. Chong. There's so many Dr. Chongs. It's such a common surname. And there was one there, but the address was different to the one I remembered. Dad then fished out an old address book, and then I found the one that was on Google. And my first task was to ring him up or make contact with him. And he did remember Mum, and I needed to find out whether he had these records. I mean, you know, medical records, you know, usually destroyed after a certain amount of time. And I didn't know whether he had them, but I was very lucky that he did have them, and he said, I'll look for them. And it took quite a bit of time. It took a few months before he could find them and then sent them to me.
Did you think twice about whether you really did want to read what was inside that private correspondence or private record?
It was a scary thing because I was worried that Mum would be nasty to me, as sometimes she was in life. I was worried that she'd be saying nasty things about Dad or nasty things about me. And I was scared of what was inside, but at the same time, I needed to look at what was inside because I was driven by this desire to find out the truth and to know what happened to her.
What kind of picture emerged from those records?
So I took the medical records down to Melbourne over Christmas, and me and Dad opened the records. And it was, her devastation was more comprehensive than I realised, because Mum and Dad had only referred to one nervous breakdown. You know, Mum would say, Mum had a nervous breakdown. But it was actually a series of breakdowns that she had had over her life. So that was kind of not surprising, but also very shocking, because I had always thought there was only one.
You wanted, after reading those records, you wanted to have a better understanding of what your mum had been like before those breakdowns, before her life in Australia. And so you reached out to two of her sisters, an older and a younger sister. What did your mum's younger sister, Madeline, tell you about what your mum had been like as a teenager in Malaysia?
She remembered a beautiful and bright young woman. And she used to go out on these dates, kind of like a double date in a sense, because at that time, Mum was courting her first husband-to-be. Adele was this charming, handsome man who came on the scene and was enraptured by Mum. And Mum was only 16, so she was very young and had stars in her eyes with this man. And they went on these dates down the coast. They went to beach dates, and my auntie would sort of play in the sand with the shells while they sort of canoodle on the beach. And that's where that romance began.
How did her Catholic parents react when they discovered that she had fallen head over heels for a Muslim man?
So my grandmother was staunchly Catholic. She was, I say, a zealot, because she was almost fanatical about about Christianity. And for her daughter to then be going out with this Muslim was unfathomable to her. It was in defiance of her Catholic beliefs. And Nan reacted violently. They had many arguments over this relationship. And in fact, Auntie Madeline remembered seeing Nan reach for a brick and try and hit Mum. Usually Nan had a bamboo stick, but this time it was, you know, Mum had crossed a line.
Your mum went ahead and married Adele, and then the marriage didn't go well. What could your other auntie, your Aunt Anne, tell you about what things were like between your mum and her first husband after your sister, her sister Sarah, had come along?
So the marriage started to disintegrate, and Mum, after she had my sister, and after she had my sister, the marriage was still on the rocks. By this time, a lot of the family had migrated to Melbourne, and Mum was left with the older sister in KL. But there were a number of times where Mum showed up to my auntie's house, distraught, crying, and with a bruised face, with baby Sarah. And Mum took refuge in Auntie Anne's house. And it was one night when they were together in the house, Auntie Anne, the other kids, my sister, when Adele turned up. And it was pitch black outside. He drove by, came into the gate, and there was a catastrophic event.
What happened?
Adele reached for baby Sarah, who my mum was holding, and took her. And he decided that their daughter, was his property. And he ran off into the night with my sister, my baby sister.
Was there anything your mum could do?
So by that stage, she had fled Adele, and Adele had verbally said, "I divorce you." And in Islam, that's all a Muslim husband has to do is to say, "I divorce you." And as, you know, Mum was a Muslim convert because she had to convert into Islam to marry Adele. And now she was divorced and she was a pariah. So according to my auntie, there wasn't much my mum could do in terms of, you know, a court fight or fighting for custody. She was a failed Muslim convert and she didn't have many rights. So Mum's family then closed ranks and decided that Mum should come to Australia. And finding this out, I realised that Mum's story wasn't a neat migrant narrative. It wasn't a story about someone coming to Australia for a better life. It was a devastating journey for her, leaving her daughter by no choice of her own back in Malaysia.
Did she try to bring Sarah out to Australia after she'd married your dad and established a life here?
So many years passed, and when my parents were together, they tried to adopt her. And in the 1980s, in 1984, I was 3 years old, the same age I was in the photo on the cover, and we went on a trip to Malaysia. And I thought, oh, this is a great holiday. We'll, you know, go to Penang and we'll go to KL. But it was more than that. It was actually this secret visit to my Sarah's school. And by that stage, Sarah was 13, 14 years old. And my sister was sitting in a classroom, and all of a sudden she gets called out of the classroom and Mum's there meeting her.
Who she hadn't seen since she was a little baby.
Since she was, you know, nearly 2 years old. Out of the blue, this strange woman from Australia saying, "I'm your mother." And that was the only time in Mum's life where she got to see Sarah again after the snatching.
So she had all of this trauma with her when she came to Australia, all of that heartbreak before she even met your dad or had you.
That's right. And this is something that I didn't know about because, again, the nervous breakdown was never explained to me. It was always just a nervous breakdown. But I wanted to know the cause and I wanted to know what happened so I could fully understand, you know, her catastrophe and feel more compassion for her.
So you'd gone on your quest to discover more and you went to Malaysia to speak with your sister Sarah, with this new knowledge, and ask her to talk to you in this different light, I guess, about the mum that you shared. What kind of conversations did the two of you have?
So my sister also had the letters that Mum used to write to her as a child, and that really opened up a whole new world and brought Mum back to life and also explained everything. It made everything make sense. And my sister was the most open of all of my relatives. I mean, she has an interest in this because she wants to know about Mum as well, but she was the most open. But I discovered that she had a very, very difficult relationship with her father and that her family had said that Mum was dead and that she grew up thinking that her mum was dead. But in her heart, my sister knew that her biological mother was not dead. There's something there. There's a connection there. And it must have been so tough for my sister to push against that because she knew something was going on, but she couldn't pinpoint it.
How did you start to see your mum differently as you read the letters that she'd sent your sister and heard about that meeting back in Malaysia and could talk together about this woman who'd been a bit of a shadow for both of you? Mm. How did you start to think about her differently, Jason?
Because I had banished her from my memory, a lot of the good memories were forgotten. And in the hotel in KL, I opened the letters and I was kind of awash with her kindness and her generosity. You know, she was very tender in these letters to my sister, saying things like pet and darling, and she was just so very kind.
And that would have let you remember those kindnesses that she'd shown to you as well.
Exactly, because I started to see Mum for the woman and not for her illness.
I'm so glad that the two of you got to have those conversations, Jason.
Absolutely, and it's a very unique thing. I mean, I'm glad that me and my sister are together in the sense that we could have chosen to be separate. We could have chosen to stay in our separate lives because, you know, we're very different. We're the odd couple. She's Muslim. She's Malaysian. She's 10 years older than me. I'm gay. I'm Australian, 10 years younger. But there's a new fondness there, and we do call each other big sister, little brother, kaka and adik. So that, you know, there is a connection there now, which I never had growing up.
The other important person, I guess, in this story is your dad. As you learnt more about your mum and the trauma she'd gone through and the efforts she and your dad had made to try to bring your sister Sarah out to Australia, how did you start thinking about your dad and the kind of husband he had been to your mum?
The thing about Dad when I was growing up, I always saw him as this strange man who spoke a different language and who had all these like particular quirks like the clocks and all of these other things. And I pushed away my Khmer heritage when I was growing up. But through this investigation, I discovered my dad's backstory and also how much he did to take care of Mum, you know, taking her to the psychiatrist and carrying her when she fell over. Because he did that numerous times. And I came to realise, reading the medical records, that Dad would have had to have superhuman strength. And of course, he's not a superhero. He's just Dad. But that was a lot for him to carry. And now I realise that, and I can see the strength and the determination and the resilience that he had to do that. And to also see that he was struggling too, because he's lost his wife, who, you know, gave him a lot of grief. You know, she was very heavy to carry in life, and then suddenly have to take care of me and worry about me going to school and all those practical things, but also having a very difficult relationship with my grandmother as well.
She might have given him a lot of grief, as you put it, but she also gave him you. How are things between the two of you now, you and your dad? You talk about that initial conversation where you came out and it was met with maybe confusion or a bit of coldness. How are things between you and your dad now?
Well, it's been a complete 360 degree turnaround for Dad, because, you know, we've gone from 15 to 16 years of deep denial of my sexuality to him watching me march in the Mardi Gras with the ABC, with the ABC float. And, you know, he watches the Mardi Gras now, I'm in it, and he complains that they don't show more of me. So that's a huge turnaround. You know, we're not at the stage where he's asking about boyfriends or partners or whatever. He still won't ask me that. But the fact that he is, you know, watching the Mardi Gras, that's a huge leap.
Those questions on that tape that we played, where you're interrogating your mum and dad about who am I, who are you, what nationality, what are you, what do you do? How are you with those questions now?
Well, I like to say that I'm all mixed up, because I come from a mixed up family. We come from all different backgrounds, and that's what it means to be Australian to me. You know, I believe that we're a great mixed up country, and that's how I see Australia and my identity. And, you know, once there was shame, but now there's pride in my heritage and who I am.
Jason, it's been a real joy to speak with you and hear your family story. Thank you so much for being my guest.
We could go on and on.
We could go on and on, but people will go and buy the book, and then they can hear all the stories that we didn't get to in this conversation. My guest today was Jason Om, and Jason's book is called All Mixed Up. I'm Sarah Kanoski. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Sarah Kanoski. For more Conversations interviews, head to the website abc.net.au/conversations.
Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.